Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. It's baseball season, and there is just nothing better than a great baseball story as the 162-game season unwinds from spring into late autumn. It's one of the reasons I love listening to Sox games on the radio or on TV. Joe Castiglione, Jerry Remy, Dennis Eckersley sharing some great ones. A couple of weeks ago in Montpelier's Bridge, Ken Libertoff shared a great one that winds from Brooklyn's Ebbets Field to Montpelier's Rec Field and stars former Major League pitcher Robin Roberts over a span of six decades. It's gold. Ken Libertoff joins us now to tell us the tale. Ken, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for Ken or if you want to share a Robin Roberts story, you can call us, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ken, writing is not what you're known for. Remind people who've been around these parts how they know the name Ken Libertoff.
Well, for 30 years, I was director of the Vermont Association for Mental Health. And very proudly try to represent citizens, particularly in the legislative process. So even though it was not a sports story, there certainly was plenty of conflict and contact and hopefully enough victories to make it a fulfilling career.
I would think so. Ken, has writing been something you've always done?
No, I think probably my writing was quite limited, actually, till recently. I think the most writing I ever did when I was, a sophomore or junior in high school, and started writing love letters to a young girl in my class. And I think my writing career sort of petered out after that. So this is a new experience. It's been about a year and a half that I've been engaged in a writing program, really, through the Montpelier Senior Center, and had some really excellent help from one of the leaders there, Maggie Thompson, who deserves a lot of credit. She's an inspiration and certainly a coach in this field. And interestingly enough, my folks in my writing class have been incredibly supportive and helpful. So there's nothing like taking on kind of a new endeavor, particularly after three quarters of a century. It's exciting.
That is great. We won't pry into how those love letters did or didn't work for you back in high school. But, Ken, you did have a pretty solid athletic career, too. Give us a little background on that.
Well, it started really on the streets of New York City. Spent an awful lot of time playing stickball and punchball, and progressed, became very much focused on basketball, which was certainly a city game back in the 1950s, and went on to attend and play basketball for the University of Connecticut in the early 1960s, and played on some very good teams, and since the reality is that things change. The shorts, the basketball shorts back then might be considered short shorts.
Yeah.
Back then, if you look at the shorts players are wearing today, there's no comparison. So the years have gone by, but the love of the game continues.
And that UConn team, you should tell people how you did in the NCAAs.
Okay, well, this is a real setup, which I appreciate. 1964, we made it to the Elite Eight in the NCAA college basketball tournament. And this was a very exciting development. Sports fans will appreciate the term Cinderella team. We were the national Cinderella team that year. And although we ended up losing to Duke in the Elite Eight game, it certainly began to put basketball on the map in the Nutmeg State.
Yeah, that was well before the Big East existed, the UConn playing in the Yankee Conference back then. I know stickball, I know basketball. Now, punchball could be one of two things, so you better explain what punchball was.
Well, you would have a little a pink rubber ball. I think it was a Spalding. Mm-hmm. And you would make a fist with your hand. This is not exactly high tech.
Mm-hmm.
You would, with lots of practice and plenty of damaged fingers, become adept at being able to hit that ball really long distances. It was a game played out on the streets, and actually was quite enjoyable.
Yeah, we called it fistball, and where I went, we had to wear ties, so we at the lunch break, we would take the ties off, we would wrap them around our fists to protect the hand a little bit more when we'd swing, and John O'Reiner was the best fistball or punchball player in our school. All right, I want to get to the piece that that you wrote for The Bridge recently about Ebbets Field and Robin Roberts. So first, tell us about Grandma Libertoff's Brooklyn apartment.
Well, my memoir story starts actually in a basement apartment in the early 1950s, where my grandmother lived in what I would call a rather dim and grim apartment, which had no natural light, and for reasons that I can't explain, seemed to have very weak light bulbs. So this was not a cheery place. Compounding the environment was the fact that an elevator that ran from the sixth floor down to the bottom of the building ended up opening right near my grandmother's apartment and partially in it, and it was a space that I often slept in. And much to my surprise, and I guess I'd say shock and sometimes horror, a person would appear out of nowhere, sort of hauling garbage pails in and out, which created a certain ambience. It's a different Brooklyn than Brooklyn we hear about today, which has become much more upscale.
Yes.
So my grandmother was not a warm or bubbly or affectionate person. She, by the time I really got to know her, she was divorced. And I think we can say or imagine that in 1950, to be a divorced woman carried a different kind of stigma than certainly we handle that issue today.
Mm-hmm.
But we had one endearing bond and connection, and that was the local Brooklyn Dodgers baseball team that played in old Ebbets Field. And I think it's fair to say that there's some relationship to the team that you mentioned, the Red Sox, who are also playing in somewhat of a neighborhood ballpark, and an old ballpark at that. Anyway, on Saturdays, it was Ladies' Day, and for three quarters, ladies young and old could get a bleacher seat. And my grandmother and I would travel over to nearby Ebbets Field. We'd sit in the bleachers, and Brooklyn at that point had a very devoted following with about 34,000 seats, and you'd be hard-pressed to find an empty seat on a Saturday afternoon. The Dodgers were, at that point, just beginning to become a much more successful team. And they often played one of the rivals with the Philadelphia Phillies team, and they had a star pitcher, and this guy was really good. He had a fastball that was hard to hit.
Well, before we get to that guy, let's talk a little bit about Ebbets Field, because it was gone before I was born, I have heard for my entire life of being a baseball fan the magic that was Ebbets Field. And, I think of great ballparks like Wrigley and Fenway, but people who have been to Ebbets Field talk about it in those same kind of reverent tones.
Well, for me, Ebbets Field was a shrine. I mean, I guess in terms for people that perhaps are of your generation, it was for many Brooklynites the Magic Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
It was a brick building rather attractive inside with a marble rotunda.
Mm.
And the seats were very close to the field. I could actually hear the players talking to each other during batting practice when I walked down to the dugouts or near the dugouts. And they had, of course, the magnificent green grass that for people in Brooklyn, I'd say the way the field looked, it was, you know, a lawn worthy of the Palace of Versailles in the middle of a kind of a poor Brooklyn neighborhood.
Yeah. And on those ladies' days, your grandmother had a certain ballpark routine. What was that?
Well, her routine was to bring peanut butter sandwiches, sometimes with jelly. And at the seventh inning stretch, we would take those peanut butter jelly sandwiches out, and we'd have some Oreo cookies and some warmed over water that she brought with her. This was not a person who was prone to buy hot dogs or French fries or drinks. We brought our own.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a intimate ballpark with loyal fans who cheered and booed with reckless abandon.
And you were sitting out there in the outfield, I believe, right?
Oh, that's right. That's right. Matter of fact, my favorite player, Duke Snider, was in center field. Mm. And Duke Snider was from a distant land that I hardly knew where it was on the map. It was a state called California.
Wow.
You have to remember that at that point, when the Dodgers took a Western trip in the National League, they were talking about going to places like St. Louis and Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
California was truly remarkably very far away from Brooklyn.
Okay, Ken, you and your grandmother, big Brooklyn Dodgers fans, but you did. You developed a fear, even a sports hatred, of Phillies pitcher Robin Roberts. Tell us how that happened.
Well, how it happened was player after player, Duke Snider, the great Jackie Robinson, Pee Wee Reese, Roy Campanella would come up against Robin Roberts, and with his blazing fastball, more often than not, he would strike them out. There were a few exceptions. I remember when Carl Furillo, the right fielder for the Dodgers, actually hit a long drive, and it hit a sign that used to be at Ebbets Field for Abe Stark clothing. If you hit that sign, a ball player would get a free suit.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl Furillo, who played right field for the Dodgers in the early 1950s, won that suit. And tears came to my eyes because I happened to know that Carl, during the offseason, was a painter in Brooklyn, house painter, to make money, to make ends meet. So it was definitely a different time.
Hmm.
So the reality is that my grandmother and I were always upset when we would see that on Saturday afternoon would be Robin Roberts facing the Dodgers. But that all came to an end in 1957.
Yeah.
When the Dodgers moved to Los Angeles, this was a devastating blow. I have to say that the glory days for me, for thousands of other fans, and for Brooklyn seemed to be way behind. And I lost my interest in baseball. It was so devastating. I was 12 years old. And for many years, I followed not at all. And then I have to admit, perhaps like you and others, I began flirting with and then became seduced by the Boston Red Sox.
Yeah.
And in later years became a Boston Red Sox fan. Well, in 2003, I was really pleased when I opened up the Times Argus to see that Montpelier was sponsoring a collegiate summer baseball team, the Mountaineers. And this sounded quite exciting, and they were playing down at the rec field. I went over to a couple of games. It was really fun and really popular, and people did a great job of putting that all together. But I happened to also read that there was a famous big leaguer, a former Hall of Famer, who became somewhat of an ambassador for the team because he had played in Montpelier on a semi-pro team in 1946 and 1947. And that really piqued my interest. I continued reading, and discovered that none other than Robin Roberts was that person. When he got out of the World War II, he signed on to play in the team representing Barry and Montpelier, and I guess somehow a scout made it up to the rec field at some point, saw the potential he had, and signed him, and thus he became a big leaguer and a star pitcher. It took me a couple of years until I attuned myself to the very game when Robin Roberts would be up and would throw out the first pitch. And I hadn't seen him for over 50 years, since 1957. Mm-hmm. So he kind of came out of the dugout, and not surprisingly, instead of that vigorous, scary guy, he was an older fella who made it out and modestly pitched the ball to the catcher. There was no more blazing fastball. And sitting next to me was some young guys, and one of them I overheard saying, "Gee, who's that old geezer out on the mound?" Which kind of got me a little bit riled up. And I said to myself, I'm going down, because I could see that after Robin Roberts pitched the opening throw, that he was sitting in the dugout somewhat by himself in the Mountaineer dugout. I went down, talked myself into the dugout. Probably I introduced myself to Robin Roberts. I towered over him. And I wouldn't be surprised if he was a little bit concerned. Who's this strange guy, and what does he want?
Right.
But he was you know, had a sweet disposition, and he shook my hand, and I quickly explained to him, and I started the conversation by confessing, "Mr. Roberts, I've hated you for many, many years because you were a Dodger killer." Anyway, we sat down and we reviewed the Dodger lineup. He asked me to go through the lineup, and he explained to me how he pitched to all my childhood heroes.
Wow.
He also explained what it was like playing in the Montpelier Barry League. And when I asked him, "Where did you play the games?" I was surprised and somewhat amazed to realize, when he said, "Right here at the rec field, this is where we played." Mm-hmm. Anyway, we had a warm and congenial 1 hour conversation. Most of the other players, you know, to some degree, were not all that aware of the magnitude of his performance when he was a young major leaguer. And near the end of our conversation, as the Mountaineer game ended, I stood up and said, "You are a great guy." Mm-hmm. And we shook hands. And there was a wonderful warmth, and sort of the arc of a lifetime was transported. Robin Roberts died a couple of years later in 2010, and there is a plaque at the Montpelier Rec Field honoring him. And as I observe in the story, I think many fans kind of just walk by that plaque, maybe with little or no recognition of who Robin Roberts was. But I can assure everyone, that's not me. And perhaps after reading the story, maybe it won't be the listeners as well as they attend a Mountaineer game this season.
Oh, I love that. A great way to remember a great man, Robin Roberts. And, you know, it's funny, Ken, we only have a couple minutes left, but, you know, we have heroes in sports, and when we meet them, we always hope that they're somewhat close to that idol that we have kind of created in our mind. But it's the ones we hate it, right? You meet, and they kind of tear down what has kind of built up over, in your case, over 50 years.
Well, that's true. And I guess there are, you know, we're never too old to have life lessons. And certainly through life, it's good to not only have passions, and in this case, boyhood passions, but as one gets older, hopefully becoming a more caring, conciliatory, and compassionate person, there is the capacity to humanize even those who we felt were Dodge Achilles, as it was back in the 1950s.
Yeah. Ken, let's see if we can get in a very quick call. We've got Stephen calling. Stephen, go right ahead. We only have about a minute.
Okay. I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed helping start the Mountaineers and building the dugouts over the years and building the press boxes and stuff. And cleaning out all the old lawnmowers, and I just enjoyed so much watching Robin Roberts throw out the first pitch in so many Mountaineers games.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, thanks for that. I got here in 03 just as that first season was getting started. And Ken, like you, it was like, getting the golden ticket. It was like winning the lottery. Oh my gosh. I was living in Barrie and we had a team right here in Montpelier, that I can get, to the ball games and just loved it. People sit in the stands, but they also bring their lawn chairs and sit down the first and third base lines. Home opener last night, the Mountaineers with, I think, a 3-2 win, and they'll play at home again tonight. You can see the Mountaineers. Ken Libertoff was director of the Vermont Association for Mental Health in Montpelier for 30 years. He's now doing some fantastic writing for the Montpelier Bridge, and he's really enjoying what he's doing. You can read this piece online at montpelierbridge.org. Ken, thanks so much for sharing this great story with us this morning.
Thanks for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
All right, you take care. We're going to take a break, and then when we return, we're going to catch up on the recent legislative session with Senate President Pro Tem Becca Ballant. And we do have, talking about baseball, a special Red Sox makeup game with the Marlins today. Coverage begins at 4:10, first pitch 5:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. It's been a strange couple of sessions in the state legislature last year and this year. Not in what has or hasn't been passed in the state house, but that COVID has caused virtual legislating for part of last year and all of this year's session, the first of the new biennium. For those of us on the outside, it feels like we were a bit distanced from our citizen legislature. Joining me now to discuss how it's felt like legislating in that Zoom-induced world and to share some of the key developments is Senate President Pro Tempore Becca Ballant of Brattleboro. Senator Ballant, it's great to have you back on Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for the invitation.
You're welcome. Listeners, you can call in with a question for Senate President Becca Ballant at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Senator Ballant, since this was a virtual session from the beginning and you've had now plenty of experience with it, how much better did things go this session compared to 2020?
Well, we certainly started with a leg up this time because we had worked out a lot of the a lot of the kinks. There were some rocky first few weeks when the pandemic first hit. First, we were trying to do our work as a Senate initially over conference phone lines, and that became quickly came apparent to us that that wasn't going to work very well. And we had an amazing IT group at the State House. Kevin Moore and his team really got us up and running. And so we actually were able to do the entire session remotely. And although I know some people in the greater Montpelier area might have felt more disconnected from the legislature, I know folks from my neck of the woods down in Windham County, Bennington County, Windsor County, they actually felt more connected because they were able to watch our work remotely for the first time ever. And so it's been an interesting mix seeing how Vermonters have interacted with the legislature in this new format. And one of our challenges going forward is to figure out how to take the best, of what worked for us in getting more Vermonters involved in our work while also retaining the tradition of being in the state house and having it really be the people's house. So that's the work that we're focused on this summer and fall is figuring out that sweet spot between the two.
Not only was that a transition, but you had the transition becoming the Senate President Pro Tem this session, and having to do it remotely and virtually. So how was that for you?
You know, it was actually a really amazing opportunity for me to practice having to balance a lot of different paradoxes. So I had to do a lot of short-term and long-term thinking at once, how to be creative and practical at the same time, balancing my optimism and my skepticism. And so it was actually a really wonderful way to begin my work because I was able to bring my chief of staff on into the State House. She could work closely with our Senate secretary and learning the ropes in the State House without having as you know, if you spend any time in the State House, everyone who's listening, there's this constant interruption. So in that way, it was a nice way for me to learn the ropes without having the constant interruptions in person. But of course, I also felt disconnected from my colleagues, and that was hard. That was really hard.
Well, let's look ahead to 2022. I know things like committee rooms, for instance, are rather small, don't have great ventilation. We aren't sure exactly that the pandemic is completely in our past. So what do you think next year's session will look like, and when we'll decide that?
Yeah, these are great questions that we're asking through a lot of different committees within the State House that has some purview over these decisions. So you've got the Joint Legislative Management Committee looking at how staff will be interacting within the building. You've got an advisory committee on the State House looking at where different committee meetings should be held. When you have a joint session of committees, making sure there's enough room within the meeting space to allow not just the public but the press. And so one thing that we're looking at is looking at technology within the committee room so that a committee hearing could still be streamed over YouTube, but allow all the members of the committee to be present there while having some of the staff perhaps working remotely, perhaps having some of the attorneys who advise the committees working remotely so that you can have more physical space in those rooms. Because one of the things that we've talked about is even when we're fully on the other side of the pandemic, I don't know if anyone's going to feel the same way they used to on being so packed in close like sardines and breathing on each other. So we had looked at an airflow study that was done within the State House and trying to make those decisions related to comfort and safety and, you know, certainly health of Vermonters and staff members while also, you know, figuring out how to make sure that you folks in the press have access. That was, I think, one of the most challenging things when I talked to reporters. Having to cover us over Zoom was really difficult. And you couldn't just grab a staff member or a House member or senator in the hallway. You had to follow up by phone or email or text. And it didn't feel as transparent as I think people wanted it to feel. Though I do think that in many ways it was the most transparent, but I understand it didn't feel that way to a lot of people.
Yeah. Looking back on what was and wasn't passed this year, what were the bills that did pass that you were most pleased with?
So I'm certainly very pleased with the amount of federal dollars that we were able to dedicate to some really important policy areas that we've been working on for years. So among them, huge investment in housing, huge investment in broadband build-out, looking at supporting the child care system here in Vermont. We know that many workers who left the workforce because of the pandemic, even when things were starting to open up a little bit more, the thing that was holding them back was lack of child care. So certainly very excited about making strides in that area. We had a significant investment in climate action, and one that I'm very proud of, a bill that perhaps was flying a little bit under the radar, was we did a voting bill, which was building on the success that we had during the pandemic of having people request ballots so that they could, send in their ballot, not have to go to a polling site. And we saw an increase in voter participation in both parties across the state. That was very encouraging. It is something that's been important to me for many years, is getting as many people involved in the political system as possible. So I'm very proud of that, Bill.
Conversely, Senator Ballin, what didn't get through in this session that you think needs to?
Well, certainly, we queued up a lot of the work that needs to be done next year, and certainly figuring out how we actualize, like on the ground, these housing investments and broadband and childcare. And, one piece that is going to take some heavy lifting is the work around the pension system. Mm-hmm. As we know, at the start of the session, there was a lot of attention put on this by the treasurer and by the various stakeholders within the system, knowing that we're looking at a huge investment down the line that will cut into our general funds if we don't figure out how to really manage those pension investments better. So there's a task force that's going to be working on it this summer. We're going to have to finish that work as we head into January. And one of the things that I'm excited about is that it is a well-balanced group of people that will be coming together to look at that, representing folks who are stakeholders within the pension system and folks that perhaps are more on the management side. But we feel like we have a good balance of people. And we also have a task force separate from this that will be looking at investments long-term, because that was something that's been frustrating for those of us in the legislature for the last, I've been in the legislature for 7 years, and every year we've put in the money that has been recommended for those pension investments, and the investments fell short. And so looking to make that a healthier system long term. I know, too, that the governor has on his punch list, he'd like to do some more on Act 250 reform.
Right.
It's something that we've taken on in the past. We came to what we thought was a good compromise before the pandemic hit, and we were not able to get that over the finish line. I was speaking with my chair of Senate Natural Resources. He knows that that is something that the House is going to be looking at again and will hopefully be giving us a bill in the early part of next session. So those are just a few of the things that we'll be looking at.
Senator Ballin, Governor Scott vetoed the municipal voting bills for non-U.S. citizens. First of all, why did you support that bill?
Well, a couple reasons, Rick. So we have in our state the system by which towns and cities can decide for themselves how they want to be governed. And part of the work that they do is reexamining their charters each year, and then on the local level, make decisions about how they want the affairs in those towns and cities to be carried out. And so we've got Winooski and Montpelier, who both, went out to their voters and vetted these ideas with them, that if you are a resident of either of those areas, that you can vote in local elections. And I think that's the most important thing for people to know. We're not talking about voting on national issues or statewide issues. We're talking about issues that affect residents in those areas. And so this is not something that the legislature has decided itself. This is about a vote in support of local control. And so we do support the rights of towns and cities and those residents to make those decisions at the local level.
The veto override session's a couple weeks away. Are there enough votes to override the governor's veto?
We will know in a few days, Rick. We're counting votes now. I hope so. I hope so. And I, of course, it is, as you can imagine, tricky at this time of year to make sure you're going to have everybody in those virtual seats, And as I said to some journalists who were asking me about it last week, voting to override a governor's decision is not one that anyone takes lightly. So those are a lot of difficult conversations to have with House members and senators, regardless of political party. People want to make sure that they are you know, making these decisions carefully and in consultation with their constituents. But, you know, I was a little surprised that the governor did decide to veto these two bills because they are, as I said, they're bills that support local control. And I was surprised. I was taken aback by his decision to vote against that.
It does bring up a bigger question that municipalities are asking if maybe there needs to be a change to these charter change rules. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, you know, I have to say it has come up repeatedly over the last few years since I've been in the State House, and I don't sit on government operations, so I know that there's some homework that I need to do over the next few months. But I certainly have heard that from my hometown is Brattleboro, and there are certainly changes that they wanted to make at the town level in Brattleboro, and they felt hamstrung by the fact that they do need to vet all the ideas at the state level. So I'm certainly open to that conversation. I think local control is incredibly important for Vermonters, and I don't know enough about what that language would look like yet to say whether I would be supportive of it, but it's certainly something that seems to be a clear outgrowth of who we believe we are as Vermonters and how we want to make decisions.
Let's talk budget. How do you feel about how American Rescue Plan funds were allotted?
Oh, my goodness. We were so, so fortunate in this state to have the congressional delegation that we have. And so for those of you who are listening who may not understand, we do get something called the small state minimum that our senators have fought for years. And so we got a very sizable package. And the challenge, and you say, you know, do I feel happy with the way that the funds have been allocated so far? You know, we've dedicated a little over half the funds so far to these buckets that I talked about at the top of the interview here, the housing, the broadband, childcare, climate, those things. But there's still hundreds of millions of dollars that have not been spoken for. And I think it has to be an ongoing conversation between the legislature, our constituents, and with the governor's office. And, you know, I feel really proud that the initial tension that we had with the governor's office around the allocation of the funds, you know, we were able to work through that. One of the things that the legislature really pushed hard on was that we wanted to make sure that there were investments that were also being made in the people, in workforce development, in Vermont State Colleges, and making sure that we are looking forward to building healthier communities long term. And it was a source of tension in that your initial plan from the governor was mostly around bricks and mortar investments. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we said was we felt the American Rescue Plan was really directed more at those human capital investments, and that the infrastructure bill that we hope that we'll get in the fall would be more geared towards the bricks and the mortar investments. So I do think we've hit on a good compromise between the executive and legislative branch. And, you know, one of the things that I think keeps all of us who are state leaders up at night is wondering, have we made the right decisions? And, you know, are we going to have to reexamine our work in January to make some other funding decisions? But that's the democratic process, is you do the best with the information that you have. And if you have to revisit, then you do that.
Governor Scott did emphasize at the beginning of the year that he wanted to keep the budget focused on affordability, regional inequity in the state. How do you think this budget accomplishes that?
Oh, certainly, you know, one of the biggest investments that we've made is on the housing side, and that touches every single corner of Vermont. And so when I first started in the legislature, I didn't fully understand the extent to which housing is actually an integral part of economic development. And of course, if you step back, it makes a lot of sense. You cannot get people into those jobs across the region if you don't have housing for those workers and the trailing families and trailing spouses that you're trying to attract here. And so I think that one of the smartest things that we did was allocate such a big chunk of change to the housing investments. And not just on new housing, but rehabbing housing, and having it flow through the regional housing organizations. And so it is one of the largest, well, I should say the largest housing investment that we've ever made up until this point. And I think the part that's hard for all of us who've been working on this issue for so long is that it still may not be enough, because we have a workforce shortage, and these two things are going to go hand in hand. Trying to get more people here to fill those critical jobs, and knowing that all of those workers are going to need safe, affordable housing. So I do think that is something that touches every corner of the state. That's definitely true for the broadband investments and childcare as well. So in that way, I do feel like it was not a budget that was focused just on sort of the Montpelier, Burlington area. It really was looking across the state at all the counties and those small towns and villages that also want to be part of this rebirth, you know, this renewal coming out of the pandemic.
With just about a minute left, Senator, I'm going to ask you a big question, but your thoughts on the bill decriminalizing small amounts of buprenorphine and why it was important?
Yeah, you know, I feel so strongly that we have to take a lot of different strategies to get our hands around what's happening with the heroin and the fentanyl epidemic here in Vermont. And here in Windham County, I have lost so many young people in my county to this emergency. And I've got dear friends who've lost their children to this. And it's touched so many families in Vermont. And I think this bill is a chance for us to say we have got to try many different strategies to move through this emergency. And, you know, one thing, too, that I'm thinking a lot about is the number of grandparents in Vermont who are now raising their kids because of the epidemic. And I know we're out of time, but I want to say that is something that I'll be thinking about as we head into the session, is how do we support those families better?
Becca Ballin is the Senate President pro tempore, represents Brattleboro. Senator Ballin, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Anytime, Rick. Happy to. Have a great day.
You too. We're going to be back after CBS News, and we're going to head to the NEK to get a roundup of some stories from Sylvia Dodge of the Barton Chronicle. And a reminder that today at 1 o'clock on WDEV, we got Charlie Papillo here with Travels for Charlie, Travels with Charlie, and then that'll be followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. In my spin around the state's media, there were several stories in the Barton Chronicle recently written by reporter Sylvia Dodge that really caught my attention, and stories that I thought would give us a nice look at what's happening in the kingdom right now. So Sylvia Dodge joins us now to discuss these stories. Sylvia, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for Sylvia Dodge or you want to share a story in the NEK that might be of interest, you can give us a call, 244-1777, toll free 877-291-8255, and you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sylvia, let's start with the good news in the lumber business there in the NEK.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
Well, you know, as we all know, lumber prices have really spiked recently. And when I was calling around to retail lumber businesses, sawmills, building contractors, et cetera, they all recognized that. But they're all doing record business. So despite a scarcity in lumber, you know, everybody seems to be doing the pandemic year, ironically, has been a great year. For example, like Colleen Goodridge at Goodridge's in Albany, they process cedar, and that's locally grown wood. Their prices are up, but they're selling to a larger market than they have. Their New England market has increased, and rough sawn lumber, like at Dave's Sawmill in Hardwick, I mean, people are looking for that. I talked to a building contractor from Glover, and he saws lumber, but he hasn't been able to do that in the last year because he's been so busy renovating people's homes. Wow. Sort of the downside of that to me is that he's renovating homes for not local people. Every single person, he said, is somebody with a summer home that's renovating it or somebody from out of state who's buying a home and renovating it. But everybody's been real busy.
How much have lumber prices skyrocketed?
Well, you know, I've seen different numbers, but, you know, it was reported in early May that, like, the price of 1,000 feet of board lumber on the commodities exchange was like $1,700 per, I think, is it 100 or 1,000 board feet? I mean, just huge. And in a very short period of time, it doubled. So, for example, at Pick and Shovel in Newport, if somebody wanted to go in and buy a piece of aspenite, which is some kind of like plywood, I guess, it's a chipboard that's glued together, it used to cost about $10 to $12 for a sheet. And now it's going for, you know, $52+ per sheet.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's a huge cost increase. And, like, the building contractors and, you know, places like Pool and Lumber, they're having a hard time quoting prices for projects or because it was so volatile, the prices were just rising incrementally.
Now, you've mentioned that definitely the demand is there, and that's driving prices up. Are there any other factors that have caused these price increases?
Well, Bill Hartman, who's the owner of Pool and Lumber, I talked to him in Derby, but he's got four stores around the state.
Mm-hmm.
He said, for example, he said that the lumber mills really drive the prices of lumber. And so the pandemic, I mean, we've all heard about the people who are sitting at home and decided to renovate their homes, so there's demand. But he said the lumber mills, you know, they had to downsize because of the pandemic. What they did do, they were doing in a socially distant, you know, pandemic style, which slowed down lumber production. And then he said truckers, you know, the pandemic caused a shortage of trucking. So, you know, you might order lumber, but with fewer truckers, they pick and choose where they want to go. So you might have to wait for your lumber if you're in a location that they don't like to drive to. And then I guess he also mentioned, and this makes sense to me, that the pandemic just really showed that there's a huge need for affordable housing across the country. And he said that there's a backlog of 5 to 7 years to really have enough affordable housing. So if we start building that, it's probably going to mean that lumber is going to be in demand for a long time to come.
Wow. And right now, even at inflated prices, are builders able to find enough lumber for what they're having to construct?
I talked to a guy named Greg Camara, and he said, this was a couple weeks ago, he was looking for framing grade plywood, and the place that he usually bought it was out of it. So he was planning to shop around. You know, Pullman Lumber, Pick and Shovel said they had a good supply of lumber, but I'm guessing, you know, if you're a hobbyist or a do-it-yourselfer, you probably can find what you need. But if you're a contractor, you might have to shop around. And Colleen Goodridge, you know, said that she thinks that her business has just boomed and she can hardly keep up with it. And they process like 1.2 million board feet of white cedar is because contractors are seeking alternatives for lumber they can't find or that's too expensive. So they're seeking out alternative things.
Will we ever, from what you've heard from people, see lumber prices drop back to pre-pandemic levels?
That's a good question. I mean, I really don't know. Mr. Hartman didn't sound like he wasn't optimistic that the prices were going to be dropping soon. But, I mean, I can't guess what's
okay.
going to happen.
Yeah, it's hard to speculate. And overall, though, Sylvia, is this a positive for the Northeast Kingdom?
Well, for that story, I think I talked to 5 or 6 business owners, and then last week I did a story about labor shortages, and I talked to somebody who couldn't find a driver. Juddy's, it's a portable toilet company, a septic company. Everybody I've talked to had a boom year, ironically, during the pandemic year. So if you're in the building trades or having something to do with that, it just sounds like it's been good for the Northeast Kingdom. I know, you know, restaurants and other places have struggled, but for the building economy, it seems like it's been good.
Well, that is a positive. Now, I'm going to turn to a story that you did that is less positive, and this is on smelt. So first of all, what the heck are smelt?
Smelt are little fish about 5 to 6 inches long, and the most popular name is rainbow smelt, and mean or just smelt. And technically, I think they're an ocean fish that spawns in fresh water. And I've read that it was in the 1900s in Michigan when people first bought smelt and stocked a lake, and then they went into the Great Lakes. And then I think early in the 1900s, they also brought smelt to Vermont. But smelt are small fish that feed bigger fish. And they're also a good game fish. I've never had a smelt, but apparently they are easy to cook and taste really good.
I've seen some recipes, and they do look like they might be good eating for humans, but it sounds like other fish love them. Now, we're going to take this smelt story to Lake Seymour. First of all, where's Lake Seymour?
It's in Morgan, Vermont.
Up along the Canadian border.
Morgan is along Route 111. Kind of between Derby, you'd go through Charleston, hit Morgan, and eventually hit Island Pond.
Yep.
If I'm remembering correctly, my roots.
And what has happened to the smelt in Lake Seymour?
They've just disappeared, at least in terms of spawning in the spring. I talked to a man named Peter Emerson, who works for Fish and Wildlife, and they, in samples that are done by anglers and by the Fish and Wildlife Department, they are finding small numbers of smelt in the lake. But, you know, in the spring after the ice was out, they would run up the brooks to spawn. And in Morgan, along Route 111, there's a big beach, and there's two giant culverts. And in the old days, you could just sit there and watch this massive fish just swimming up there. You know, people used to be able to stick a net in and fill, like, the buckets with these fish. And it's just gone in terms of the smelt run.
So does anyone know why the smelt have disappeared from Lake Seymour?
Pete Emerson, no. They really, really don't. It's a mystery. I mean, the conclusion that he was telling me and that I've read about in the Great Lakes is that because predator fish like brown trout and lake trout and bass in Lake Seymour are thriving, it's possible that they're just eating most of the smelt. And that's why they've disappeared. But, you know, when in reading stories and in talking to him, I think they're worried about it still. It's a little bit of a mystery because, you know, they're there and then they're gone. At nearby Lake Echo Lake, which is in Charleston, which is over the hill from Lake Seymour, I talked to a man named Pete Engels who said 25 years ago you could walk across the brook, that's his quote, during when the smelt were running upstream, and they just are gone.
Because there was so many smelt, you could just walk on the backs of the smelt.
Yeah, that's what he was saying.
I got it. So that happened at Echo Lake. Are there other lakes in the kingdom that are seeing what's going on at Seymour or what happened at Echo Lake 25 years ago?
I haven't been told of any other lakes, and there are lakes where smelt are running because what Fish and Wildlife is doing is in Willoughby Lake in Westmore and at Harvey's Lake in West Barnett and at Joe's Pond in Danville. They have a program where they're collecting smelt eggs by laying burlap on the bottom of the streams where the smelt run. And once they spawn and they drop fertilized eggs, they're taking this burlap and bringing it to Lake Seymour to try to reinvigorate the smelt. So there are still smelt runs in other lakes in Vermont. I haven't heard of other places where they've disappeared.
And what could what effect could the loss of smelt have on the other fish population at Seymour?
Well, as Pete Emerson said, a lot of fishermen are worried about it because they're worried that their, you know, trout fishing will be impacted if there aren't smelt. But he said trout were here before the smelt were, so smelt will survive. But, you know, smelt is part of an ecosystem that it makes a healthy lake these days. And the fact that something just sort of disappears is obviously troublesome.
That's interesting because they're non-native. We usually think of a non-native species as something, you know, very negative, and the loss of them would be somewhat positive. It looks like now the ecosystem has gotten to the point where smelt has become an important part of that.
Yeah, yep. I mean, and there are other fish. If you read back into, you know, that, I think there's a historic, quote-unquote, steelhead rainbow trout run up the Willoughby River, and there are waterfalls in Orleans, and they jump. And it's kind of like, you know, watching Atlantic salmon jump. But I believe those fish were introduced into Vermont, that they weren't native here. They live in Lake Nepomagog, and then they spawn up the Willoughby River. So I don't think smelt are the only fish that were brought here, you know, a century or so ago.
And when do people typically catch smelt?
Well, the spawning run is in the spring, but the best time to fish for them, according to Mr. Emerson, is through the ice. I guess you set up, I'm not an ice fisherman,
up
on the ice near where a brook, you know, where the smelt would run, and fish for them there through the ice.
Gotcha. Let's go to the phones. Take a call from Stephen in Montpelier. Good morning, Stephen.
Hi, I have a logging story about the Northeast Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, I was paddling up the Connecticut River, paddled under an old railroad bridge and through a marsh and up to a stream, again, up that was coming down from the Northeast Kingdom woods. So we tied up our canoe and climbed up along this rocky stream and got to a point where there, on either side of the stream, there were two chains hanging down, and one chain had a block of wood. And up above that, there was this huge marsh. So I did some research, and it turns out that during the winter, they would log and bring logs into this marsh, and they had the chain across with a block of wood. And they filled the whole thing up. So in the spring, when there was lots of water, some brave soul would come with an axe and knock out the block of wood, and all these logs would come tumbling down into the Connecticut River. And then eventually they'd go down the river all the way down to Bellows Falls and wherever they went to be processed.
Yeah, Stephen, that's a great story and a great reminder that I need to do a show on the log runs down the Connecticut River, the history of that, which went on for quite some time. Those lumberjacks certainly took their lives in their own hands, knew what they were doing, but a difficult skill. So thanks for reminding us.
There's a great story in the Vermont Almanac.
Oh, right. Okay. We'll get to that. Great to bring that up as we were talking about the lumber in the kingdom with Sylvia Dodge. Sylvia, I want to turn now to your story on the Dirt Church. First of all, what is the Dirt Church?
Well, the Dirt Church is the name of a new brewery and tasting room in East Haven that is planned to be opened on July 4th, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it also includes a historic church that's been renovated that will be a venue for music and weddings and art exhibits. It's being started by a pair of people. The man is from Connecticut, and the woman, she told me, is originally from New Hampshire. They're mountain bikers, and Dirt Church, the term Dirt Church, apparently means for mountain bikers on Sunday, instead of sitting in a building with a minister talking and a psalm book. They just get out in the woods and ride hard, and that's, you know, where they find their spiritualism. So Dirt Church is a reference, I think, to a spiritual way for mountain bikers to spend their Sunday, 60 miles on trails, getting muddy and bumpy and, you know, and really working out.
communing with nature. Before Dirt Church, what kind of businesses were or are there in East Haven?
East Haven is a tiny town. It has, you know, right on Route 114 where Dirt Church will be located. I think there's only a little slice of 114 that's in East Haven, and so Andy's Gun Shop is on Route 114, and then he also has an automobile shop in the village, an auto repair shop, and there's a veterinary clinic in the village, and there's a goat farm, you know, on the hill up to the old radar base. But there aren't very many businesses in East Haven, so this will, you know, it's welcomed by the people to add to the tax base, and it should bring some excitement to the community.
Tell us a tiny bit about the old radar base and how East Haven kind of grew around that.
Yeah, the radar base was built in 1956, and it closed in 1963. So for all the work put into it, it didn't stay there very long. So the village of East Haven is across the east branch of the Passumpsic River from Route 114. And if you go there, you'll see that it's largely company housing that was built for the people who worked at the radar base. But then they abandoned it. And so now there are these hulking metal buildings on the top of the mountain. Supposedly, it's the second highest peak in the Northeast Kingdom, and supposedly the federal government flattened the top to build this radar base. And then a man named Jack Sawyer, I think his name was, bought it. And supposedly he made his money as an ad man in New York City. Supposedly he coined the term Maxwell House, good to the last drop.
Oh.
And, in fact, my cousin Linda worked for him making toys. There were Quonset huts they just left up there. I mean, the waste, really. I visited as a child up there. And it was just, they just left everything. And people came and, you know, ripped up. There were Coke coolers and, you know, doors and everything. Oh, but so it's kind of an exotic, unique feature. You know, had a short-term radar base, but now the radar base is gone.
Now, why did this couple who are opening the new microbrewery decide to do it in East Haven, which is quite small, and Essex County, which has no other microbreweries?
Well, they met at the Circum Burke bike race. It's a bike and running race that went around Burke and into Victory, and Kingdom Trails has expanded north into East Haven. There's a whole new, really challenging mountain biking network called the Moose Haven Network that is in East Haven. So I think they recognized that was a hub for mountain biking. It's about halfway where they're located between East Burke, that's Kingdom Trails and Burke Mountain, and Island Pond, which has Island Pond for summer recreation and, you know, is known as a snowmobiling mecca. It's on a well-traveled highway, so it's easy to get to. I mean, I think they're going to thrive there. I think it's a great location. And, you know, during the pandemic, the man's name is Bruce Lindsay. He's a home brewer, had been, and so they just wanted to follow their dream.
And mountain bikers who are on the Kingdom Trails, looks like July 4th and onwards, you'll have a great place to stop in for to quench your thirst. Do they have events planned with mountain biking at Dirt Church?
Their website showed a sign up for Sunday rides, and I saw, you know, a sign up for weddings, but at this point I didn't see that they have other events planned at this point in time.
All right. Now, I know another story that you just did will make some fairgoers very happy. Looks like the Demolition Derby is coming back.
Yes. Yep. And the fairs are coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they were both canceled, the Caledonia County Fair and the Orleans County Fair last year. A difference for the Orleans County Fair this year is that it always was held in mid-August before the Caledonia County Fair, but this year it's going to be held in September. And there's work going on right now because the state has required some renovation to tracks to hold a Demolition Derby event. So they're planning their Demolition Derby debut on July 4th. They have to move the stage and the announcer's booth for the Demolition Derby farther away from the grandstand. And they have to essentially build like a second track to run alongside the original track. so that, for safety issues, so that cars won't crash into people. Interestingly, at Caledonia County, I think this is an interesting story. Dick Lawrence, the president of the Fair Association, he was required, all fairs were required to look at demolition derby safety, and he enlisted the help of physicists and mathematicians from NVU Linden and mathematically proved that a car can't crash into the crowd, and so the state, they had to present that case to the state of Vermont, and they don't have to do anything to their track because apparently mathematically a car can't crash into the stands at the Caledonia County Fairgrounds.
And people said, Sylvia, when we were sitting in those classes in grade school and high school, I'll never use this math stuff again in my life, right?
Well, he enlisted the help of people who can do math.
Absolutely.
I couldn't have done that.
I gotcha. Oh, that's a great story. Sylvia Dodge is a reporter for the Barton Chronicle, and you can find her stories in the paper or at bartonchronicle.com. Sylvia, thanks so much for being on the program this morning.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's great having you. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we're going to be joined by Chef Joey Buttendorf to learn about the Kingdom Kitchen Academy. Community Kitchen Academy, I'm sorry. And a reminder that the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference now just once a week. That's Tuesdays. So you'll hear it tomorrow here at 11 o'clock on WDEV. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Capstone Community Action has developed many programs to help those in the central Vermont area. One of those operated through the Vermont Food Bank is the Community Kitchen Academy. It's run by Chef Joey Buttendorf, and she's with me now to let you know what it's all about and who can participate. Chef Joey, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thanks, bud. How's it going?
It's going great. Great to have you back. And listeners, if you have had a question for Joey or about Community Kitchen Academy, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. The email is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. If you've gone through the program, we'd love to hear from you as well. Now, Chef, what exactly is the Community Kitchen Academy?
Well, the Community Kitchen Academy is this fantastic program. There are two of them, one in Burlington and one in Barrie. The Burlington location is with partnered with Feeding Chittenden, and the Barrie location is partnered with Capstone Community Action Agency. So it's a great program, Rick, that New England Culinary Institute and the Food Bank partnered up about 11 years ago now, and formed a certificate program that originally was a 12-week program, but in lieu of COVID, we have transformed it into a 7-week program where students can learn anything from, basic cooking skills to getting their CERCE certification. It's very hands-on. We resource food that's given to us through the Vermont Food Bank and our food shelves that are attached to our kitchens, and teach students basic culinary skills to help them become more workforce eligible, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, who are the students? Who attends?
Well, they're adults, and they can be adults that want to learn a new career. They can be adults that may have had some trauma or challenges in their life that need to kind of re-enter into the workforce. They are anyone from the age of 18 to, I'm going to say, 85 if they want. And they can come in, and through the kitchen, I think we learn a lot of other things besides cooking, We learn how to work together. We learn how to respect each other. We learn how to be a team player, how to have time management skills that become better and better, as Stephanie Shell would say. We learn how to properly store and handle food. We learn how to become organized. We take inventories. We do all kinds of things. So not necessarily do the students go out and get actual culinary jobs. They could get any job. These skills help them in any job that they're looking for. We help build confidence. We do all kinds of things with them. So if you are interested in the program and you're curious about how to get there, you can come to our websites, any one of them, the Vermont Food Bank or the Capstone websites. There's applications and information on those websites for students to apply. And then we do an interview and see what happens and see if they're eligible.
You mentioned, Joey, that it now goes for 7 weeks. So first of all, how often a week do you meet? What are the hours? And then how many times a year do you have these sessions?
Yeah. Thanks, Rick. Great question. So we actually meet 4 days a week here at Capstone from 9 in the morning till 3:30 in the afternoon. We run it for 7 weeks straight if there's a holiday in between. We'll make up that time. Students need to have, upon receiving their certificate, about 240 hours of lab time. So that's real hands-on lab time. Working with me, working with other people here at Capstone, working with volunteers in the food shelf, learning how to be confident again and how to get your strength back and how to work your way back into society. But, so we adopted it from the 12-week program, and we fit a lot of information into 7 weeks.
Hmm.
And we run them 5 times a year, Rick.
When's the next one coming up?
We actually have a start, and I have 1 or 2 spots left for a start next Thursday on the 17th.
Oh, my.
And that'll run through August, the first or second week of August. And then we have another start late August that'll run through October. And then we have a November start. So we go, you know, we have about 4 weeks, 3-4 weeks in between sessions.
And people can find out information at the Vermont Food Bank website, also Feeding Chittenden and Capstone Community Action, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Or they can give me a call if they want to. My extension here at Capstone is 802-477-5121. Just call Capstone main line numbers too, and they'll get the information that they need.
All right. What is your goal for the students, by time they graduate, Joey?
My goal is that they feel better about themselves, number one, from when they walked in the door, that they have learned some sort of skill set that they didn't learn before. And that they live a quality of life that is suitable for them, you know, that they can start to become satisfied with their accomplishments in life. That's a huge thing for me. And if it's a change for somebody, you know, a career change, that's the same thing. It's a new thing, and it can be scary to want to change, and it can be a passion that they have, and they should feed that passion and not be afraid, taking risks. Good risk is a good thing.
Yeah. You mentioned that not everyone who goes through the program necessarily wants to go into food service when they finish the Kitchen Academy. But for those who do, what kind of jobs have they gotten coming out of the CKA?
Oh, man. I have 3 alumni right now working at the Berry Country Club as cooks, prep cooks, front of the house people. They can do just about anything from, if they have no experience, Rick, and they come to my program and they're here for 7 weeks, they'll be able to leave and they could work a cold station on a line. They could prep, be a prep cook, be a steward, do some ordering and inventory. They'll learn all of those skills. So I've had multiple facets of jobs. Students that leave and create their own products and sell them, you know, doing their own little micro biz is a huge piece of this. If they're interested in that, some students go off and continue their education. So it really depends. I've had students go off and work in dental offices as administrative assistants. I've had students become executive assistants, you know, with those skills that they've reoriented themselves with. So it really depends on the person and what they want. Students talk about food trucks a lot. And with COVID right now, I want to say I get multiple phone calls and emails a day for people out there who need workers, as we know. We've all heard that in the news right now.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody can find any help. So for
anyone who needs to hone in on skills that may not, that's in the industry, that may not have gotten, you know, a certificate or any formal training, this is a great program for them too. And you, like I said, anybody who's changing careers. But I can almost guarantee like a 90% placement for my class right now.
Wow.
Because of the amount of jobs available. And so I would say front of the house, hotels, resorts, they could work in any kind of those environments, Rick, you know?
Fantastic. And anyone, yeah, anyone who's cooked, I mean, I was making a big thing of mac and cheese last night. When you're learning right, cooking skills, you're learning multitasking and time management like, you know, like no other. So
yeah,
it really
like
does.
A Formula One race car driver.
Yeah, exactly. It really is,
yeah,
that. Yeah. Where do you get the food that you cook with? And then what happens to the prepared food?
Well, my basic stuff, you know, everybody has a pantry, right?
So right,
spices, oils, vinegars, that kind of thing. I order through Sysco or Reinhardt or Macaulay or Black River if I need some supplement stuff. But that's not very often. The food bank supplies what we need for like main dishes and things like proteins and big batch vegetables. Community Harvest also is a partner with us. We take gleaned vegetables from them.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll take food that may not necessarily be used or sold or that has been donated to the food bank and utilize that food and create meals for the food shelf. And for pilots that Capstone has going on, we have quite a few meal pilots happening right now around the community. So,
What's a dish that somebody might learn to make, let's say, in the first couple of weeks of being at the Academy?
Well, the first thing we do is progressive education, right? So we start with soups and stocks and sauces, right?
Yep.
So we have to have the good base for that. Once we get the stocks done, they'll make anything from roasted chickens, braised chickens, braising pork butts. They'll make stews and soups and big batch pasta dishes. You know, you said mac and cheese. We do that like once or twice a month for sure. We'll do lasagnas. We'll do baked fish sometimes, depending on what I'm allowed to get. And it's really, or what's available to me, really. It's important that we teach all of those classic culinary skills. So they learn how to sear. They learn how to poach and braise and do all of those cooking methods. We might do cornflake fried chicken sometimes, you know.
Yep. That's fantastic. That's the way grandma used to make it. Chef, what skills do you find that most of your students require when they first get started there?
What skills do they require?
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't hear it.
Yep.
Oh. That's a great question. None. No, I'm just kidding.
Wow, that makes your job easy.
Well, with a mixed demographic, sure. You know, it does take a special chef. I actually had a conversation the other day with another NECI chef, Chef Jim, actually, from my sister program of Burlington, and we were speaking and saying, there's 25 or 30 of us NECI chefs here in the state, and it is a special skill to be able to teach multiple demographics and personalities all at once every day, you know, but we love it. So the skill that they need to have, I would say, is some social skills, right? We ask that a student coming has a GED or a high school diploma, Rick, but we don't require that because we do have, in Barrie anyway, and in Burlington, we have a really good relationship with adult basic education that can help work with our students to obtain those GEDs and diplomas. So if they're working on it while they're in class, then we kind of make special exceptions for that because we know that it can be a perfect candidate and that might be the only thing holding them back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we're not going to let that happen. We have too many networks and community resources that help us enroll our students a lot. They refer a lot of students to us. And in Barrie, we work with them really closely. So it's awesome. I would say, you know, some social skills and some respect for themselves a little bit and to want to learn, Rick, really. If somebody walks in and is open and willing to learn something new and from people and be positive and be in an environment that's going to make you feel good, then that's important to me. The rest will happen naturally.
And then taking it up a notch, you know, what do you teach them about actually working in a professional kitchen, which is a world unto itself?
Yes.
A subculture of society, eh?
or a higher strata of society.
Right. Well, now it is, for sure, right?
Yeah.
It's a very big deal working in kitchens. We see it on TV. We see it in master classes online. We see all the famous stuff. Yeah, there is a standard. I mean, the standard number one is attitude. You have to have a good attitude. Number two, you have to want to work hard. Number three, you have to have respect again and understand what the chef's role is. The chef's role is not to just nitpick at you and tell you what to do. Our role is to educate you to be better every day, get better every day, hone in that skill every day. If you were able to learn how to ride a bike from your parents when you were little, it's that kind of thing, or learn how to swim or had a coach that was really important to you. That's what chefs are, you know, and that's what we do. So we live by those classic standards of, you know, from where it came from, the cruise ships and the fine dining and the uniforms and the brigade and the safety first and understanding how to take care of your food and love food first. And my chef world is really cool because it's so diverse. I do this, but I also do some consulting and other things to keep myself in the food trend and in the food scene in Vermont and am able to work with food that would be resourced and use my blind basket, literally brain every day, come into work and, you know, kind of put things together from what's here.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get to go work with local farmers at the same time. I actually took my last session of students to Camp Mead, Rick, and we worked in the big turtle oven. Randy was so great at Red Hen and let us go up there with our pizza dough, and we made flatbreads all day. And, you know, so we do things like that to kind of get us out of a professional kitchen, but then in that setting, still understand that love and respect for food, even if it's a casual setting as well. So, you know, getting to know your community, farmers, all that stuff is really important here as well. I actually created a little garden last year. Thank you, Capstone, for letting me tear up the daylilies and put a little garden up back in the kitchen. So I did that. I have a little urban garden. It's awesome.
Oh, I love it. What do you enjoy most about teaching at Kitchen Academy?
Paying it forward and watching the successes after. Just like with anything else, I think I love inspiring if I can in a positive way. Rick, you've known me for a long time, so it's just sort of in my DNA. Thanks, Mama Wendy. Thanks, Dad. But I do want to say that, you know, that's the biggest thing for me. I had amazing mentors in my life. I've had amazing influences, amazing experiences. And I want to share those with people so maybe their world just gets a little bigger and they get a little more inspired and they become a little more cultured and a little more educated, you know, that kind of thing.
Now, the next Kitchen Academy in both Burlington and Barrie start next Thursday. Who should consider enrolling and how do they go about it?
I would say anybody who's sitting on the couch right now not knowing what to do with themselves.
Right? That's some of us.
No, really. And COVID can do that. COVID may have made you feel like you need a change or, you know, maybe there's somebody out there that's worked in insurance their whole life and wants to be a cook, really. I mean, that's a great candidate. Somebody who may have had some challenges in life, anybody, like I said, over the age of 18, if you're young, from 18 to 22, and you're not quite sure what to do with your life, and life has been hard for you, please come see us. We're going to help you. We're going to get you up on your feet. We're going to give you the confidence you need to get a job. You can, like I said, you can call the main numbers at Capstone or Feeding Chittenden, and you will get information for CKA, and somebody will direct you to our websites or send you an application if we need to. You can stop by either place and pick up an application for CKA. You can visit both websites. You can call me directly, you know, however you want. We do have a Facebook page for CKA, too, so if somebody wants to shoot that a message, I'll look at that frequently, you know, once or twice a week for sure. I'll look at it more now. But, yeah, I think, you know, we're not hard to find, and we're here, and we're here to help, and we're here to support, and we're here to give you skills that you need to have a better quality of life, really.
And, Chef Joey, it is the 7th. The first day of the next class is the 17th. So what will happen in those 10 days for someone? Imagine someone right now listening who 10 days from now enrolled in one of those classes.
Yeah. Well, ask yourself if you're able to come Monday through Thursday, first of all, are you able to get here? If you're able to do that, if you fill out an application online, you're going to receive a phone call from me or Chef Jim within the next 24 to 48 hours. We're going to talk to you for a minute. We're going to set up a time to do an interview. That can happen either via Zoom, Rick, via phone call. But we really like to see you live, and we have to kind of give you a tour of the facility and make sure you're comfortable in this environment, you know. It's really a quick process. So the steps are fill out an application. You'll receive a call. There's a few more documents for the food bank. We send those in. You meet with us. We set you up with uniforms and talk more details and get a little bit more documentation needed for Feeding Chittenden and for Capstone. And then you're ready to start class. So the process can happen very quickly. So if you're ready as a potential, you know, and you're able to sacrifice those 7 weeks, it really goes by fast. It's really worthwhile. You will end up with a better paying job at the end, at least more money per hour or more of a salary based on your skill that you've learned here. You'll become ServSafe certified. You'll get a level one training from the Department of Liquor Control. You could get a job bartending. You can work in a liquor store. You can do retail. You can do just about anything. So please don't hesitate to call us and just ask questions if that's what you have.
And is there a cost, a tuition, to be part of the program?
Well, it's interesting. For those students that are eligible, there is no cost. It can be funded through private funds, states, federal, whatever. You know, most students don't pay out of their pocket for that. We also offer a stipend, Rick. You know, we know it costs money to get here. If you have to put gas in your car, if you're driving from St. Jay, for example, or you're driving 20 minutes even, or you might need just $50 a week for groceries. So we do give a $50 a week stipend for a perfect attendance in class. So that's an incentive as well. And again, we set you up with job placement. We help you build your resume. We'll do interviews over the phone or via Zoom from here. You know, so right. That there is no reason that people, if you're technologically hurting, you don't have a computer, you may not have a smartphone, don't let that stop you. Come to us anyway. We're going to help you gain the resources you need to become, you know, able to function better in this new modern COVID society, right?
You got it. Joey Buttendorf is the Senior Chief Instructor for the Community Kitchen Academy at Capstone Community Action in Barrie. To learn more about the program, visit capstonevt.org. Joey, always a joy having you on the program. Thanks so much.
Rick, we better see each other this summer sometime, buddy. It's
absolutely
great to hear from you.
All right,
Thank you so much for having me on, Rick. Really,
oh, it's our pleasure. Now I'm very hungry. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.